You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We are really blessed today. We have with us Kelly Peeler, who is the founder and CEO of Next Gen Best. What she wants to do is find the most convenient way for students to make money decisions, starting with paying for college. Huge difference from the time when I graduated from college and today in terms of cost. So what Next Gen Best does is partner students with a money mentor over a text message, and they get help 24/7. And as of 2015, $2.7 billion went unclaimed in free federal aid for college students because they didn't fill out the appropriate forms. So tell us, Kelly, how have you been able to do this wonderful thing for students to help them understand better about what their finances are?
So we do it all over text message, which is the medium that most young people communicate most efficiently on. So sort of gone are the days of textbooks, of even email. SMS or text message is really where you see the highest amount of engagement, response rate, reading actual messages and opening messages. So the first is the medium, is we're reaching students and young people on the medium that they actually are paying attention to. And the second is that we're delivering a highly convenient way for them to go from point A to point B, which is understanding if they want to pay for college, how do they do it the most efficiently and cost-effective way. So what that doesn't look like is an in-person meeting with a college counselor or a financial advisor. What it looks like for us and what we believe students really want is something that's available to them on demand at like 11 o'clock at night on the weekend when they're actually thinking about this stuff. So that's where the time component and the medium component has proved to be really relevant for us.
Well, Kelly, tell us how did you get to this place?
I've started multiple companies and nonprofits in the past. This is my third company and or nonprofit that I've started since college. So I've always really enjoyed, and all my previous companies have been focused on the student demo. So I helped build the first student-run incubator in Iraq in 2013. Went over to Iraq to work with students over there to help them rebuild their economy. So we've built several companies out of that that are all based in Iraq. I've started multiple different female entrepreneurship and or like broader networking communities for college women. So whether it's college women, post-war zone college students, or now highly indebted students, I'm personally very passionate about working with students and helping them do whatever it is that they want to do. And on the flip side, when I was in college, I was in college during the last financial crisis in 2008 at Harvard, and was lucky enough to work under some pretty preeminent financial historians. So I studied the history of financial crises, and that's really where I have two very different interests. One is the history of financial crises. The other is working with students. So I had, right after college, went to go work on Wall Street at J.P. Morgan. And that's really where I personally got my hands dirty, understanding how fraudulent, how predatory the student loan market is, both from a perspective on a financial side, but also from a user perspective. Essentially, Next Gen Best is the fusion of those two very different interests for me. I'm a big believer that the next financial crisis is rooted in the student loan market, and that it will be the number one thing that prevents the next generation from pursuing the careers that they want, living in the cities that they want, having the type of family that they want, because the average student graduates with $37,000 in student loan debt.
Right. So it's not just lack of attention by the student on the student loans. It's actually fraudulent and incompetence on the part of the loaners.
It's a bit of a generalization, but I'll just point to specifics around fraudulent practices or in the process of being deemed. The CFPB, which is a regulatory entity, has recently hit student loan servicers with fraud charges, for example. We just see lots and lots of examples of how there's just very misleading practices, whether it's the paperwork, whether it's a lack of disclosures of interest rates that are, if anything, just very misleading to students.
All right. So what should students or parents of students getting ready to go to college, what should they be paying attention to?
They should be paying attention to a few key things. The first is coming up with a financially relevant school list. So what we see a lot of times is that a student will go visit a random smattering of colleges. They will get their heart set on one, and then it will become their dream school. So I don't know if you've dealt with any teenagers recently, but once they kind of get their heart set on something, it becomes impossible to convince them otherwise, and they're very persuasive. So a parent is sort of put in a tough position where the dream school might be one that's out of state, is small liberal arts college with a small endowment, so not a lot of financial aid, and no access to like in-state grants or federal programs that they could take advantage of. So I would say one is come up with a financially reasonable list of colleges to even start looking at. The second is to actually be aware of all the different free federal funding programs that are available. So the stat that you mentioned before is pretty staggering. $2.7 billion of free federal aid goes unclaimed every year, and that's because families do not fill out the correct paperwork, namely the FAFSA. So that's really the second key bucket. And then the third is, to fill that out every year, and then the third is that you can actually think about negotiating your college tuition. So we helped students last year negotiate about $280,000 worth of their financial aid packages, which is, of course, not a guarantee, but you might as well try. And a lot of families don't know that they can do that.
All right. So talk to me about what you can do to help them and what you would like them to do with you.
The ways that we help students is by, first of all, being available 24/7 over text message. So they will get kind of coached along the key deadlines, forms, and pathways. We help them with anything from finding scholarships that are a good fit for them to helping them fill out the FAFSA, to helping them come up with that college list, to then helping them negotiate their college tuition and filing an appeal, to then thinking about as they're going into college, if they need things like a private loan, which private loan should I take and how do I actually understand the different terms of the private loan? If I'm going out of state and need to get a new bank, what bank is the best bank to be working with? If I'm thinking about consolidating my loans or picking a major, how do I think about that in the context of my earnings potential? So that I can actually pay off my loan. So kind of like a personal financial assistant for any money decision that they come across.
Somebody pay for this? How do they use your services?
They can just go to nextgenvest.com, and we're currently in 7 cities. And so when we launch a city, we very quickly become that trusted partner for go-to college students. But yeah, you can just go on nextgenvest.com and sign up there.
And what cities are you in right now?
Currently in New York, Chicago, D.C., Philadelphia, Oklahoma City, Houston. Not fully in Los Angeles yet. Nope, but we will be.
And I assume that would include Orange County.
No. We're primarily focused on regions where students are low to middle income. So broadly in L.A., likely not Orange County.
All right. So they would simply go to nextgenvest.com and sign up.
Yep.
And then what's the process? What happens?
Then they get connected and partnered with. You have to fill out kind of a short form so that we understand what grade you're in, what college you might be interested in going to, what you might need help with. And then they're partnered with what we call a money mentor, who's a trained college student, so that you can actually get to know them and start getting help as soon as possible based on what you need.
So this would be low to middle income would find this very, very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, the average 20% of high schools in the U.S. don't have a college counselor. The average high school has, outside of those, the average ratio from college counselors to students is about one college counselor serving 500 students. So you can imagine how difficult that is for that college counselor. So that basically just means that a lot of students aren't getting help.
So when do you think you'll be in L.A.?
We'll be in L.A. Before Labor Day, since a lot of schools are getting kind of prepared to be starting their academic school year then.
Good. So that might be something that we could publicize in L.A., and especially in low- to middle-income areas and organizations.
That would be great.
students should be paying attention to this.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of adults sort of think that students are oblivious to the cost of college, but we just see a very personal side to working with students. That a surprising amount of them are actually like really anxious about the cost of college, or very stressed about it, or just very confused and lonely through a pretty complex process. So we just want to make their lives easier, essentially.
Is it all in English, or do you have other languages?
It's all so it's primarily in English, but we do have several money mentors who speak Spanish. Since we have a lot, we've been recently having a lot of students who are ESL students. So we have a few money mentors who speak Spanish, but we'll hopefully be working to increase that access this year as well.
Good. Now, it's you know, I'm coming to understand it's very different from when I went to school, which was between 65 and 69 in Texas.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to be a National Merit Scholar. I did not come from the most wealthy group. and so for me, being a National Merit Scholar meant I really didn't have to worry about money, college. But today, it seems to me that college, going to college, is really an investment.
Yes. So the rate of college tuition has increased higher than the rate of inflation for the past 30 years, which is staggering. So if you go to NYU, for example, it's upwards of $70,000 a year. So the price of college just has steadily gone up. Very similar, I would draw the comparison to housing prices pre-financial crisis. So yes, it's now become kind of a socialized concept that because going to college is really linked and tied to this idea of success as part of being an American, it causes a lot of families to make economic decisions that are not necessarily rational. So not every student, in my personal opinion, should be paying $50,000 a year to go to college. They could be doing other things like a year at community college that's cheaper, and then transferring in, going to vocational training programs, whether it be web development, coding schools, or like traditional vocational training. So yes, there's become essentially a shrinking of options in terms of the actual programs. There's no a la carte system for higher education. It's basically a 4 year bachelor's degree. And then also on top of that, it's become exponentially more expensive. So it becomes incredibly difficult for people who are either employing millennials or just building products for them to understand that it's a totally different financial decision now versus 20 years ago.
Yeah, it seems to me like it's a major shift in the way that we think about what college is. I think when When I was growing up, college was a rite of passage. It was mm-hmm. part of how you became an adult. What I'm seeing now, I'm concluding now, that with the enormous amount of investment that really is pushed off to the future in many cases, you have to really think about how are you going to pay that back? How is this investment going to have a return on this investment?
Yeah, and I think that's like a big component that's missing in that broader calculation that we help students and their families with, is actually coming up with a literal plan. So a lot of people just sort of like procrastinate and think that, you know, I'll get a job at some point, but we just see thousands of students who are about to graduate from college and they don't have a job, nor do they even have a firm handle on how much they literally owe. Because it's sitting in different spots, it's at different interest rates, so they don't actually know the full extent of how much they owe, because it's very complex.
It's kind of a double bind, isn't it? Because the people who have to make these enormous decisions are apparently going to college to learn how to make those decisions, yet they're being asked to make those decisions which have lots of consequences before they go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're making easily your biggest financial decision of your life as a hormonal 18-year-old. And a lot of times people assume that it's your parents who are making that decision for you or on your behalf. And for our users, especially, you know, first-generation college students, it's literally an 18-year-old who's filling out the paperwork, who is figuring out where to send their applications, who's figuring out how to take out a loan. And that's that, you know, you're not allowed to more broadly take out a credit card before you're 18. So thinking about being able to take out, you know, $40,000 for 1 year in student loans without fully understanding the consequences of it, nor having to have taken an education class, like an actual class on that, is pretty predatory in our opinion.
Right. Well, now, a question for you. My wife and I do a lot of work with homeless folks, and some of these are 25 to 30, and they dropped out of society, and they are coming back in. They're clean and sober, and they're thinking about going to community college.
Yep.
I'm wondering, would this be something that would be helpful, valuable to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that we broadly, and I would also just frame what we're doing as providing positive encouragement as well. Sometimes a lot of students, especially those who are thinking about dropping out or have already dropped out of college, it's just a really lonely and shameful experience. So sometimes a lot of people just like don't literally have no one to talk to because their financial aid office is only open 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. Whether it's just broadly thinking about enrolling in the community college, we can be helpful. Whether it's thinking about, okay, how am I actually going to pay for community college? We can be helpful. Also, are there other options from community college, like getting a couple different jobs or thinking about different programs? We can certainly be helpful there, too.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, this is very, very helpful. And it sounds like you're really doing a wonderful offering a wonderful service to people who otherwise would be going into this almost blind.
Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of really terrifying things from my perspective of students saying things like, oh, this college gave me, you know, $19,000 to go to their school. And we take a look at their forms and it's like, no, you actually owe $19,000 plus interest. So, yes, I can't really underscore enough how confusing and complex these decisions are, and you cannot default from federal student loans. So basically, once you sign on the dotted line, that debt will follow you forever. You can't declare bankruptcy on that debt. So it is very important that you actually understand and get it right.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Kelly. We're going to take a little break right now. Will you stick around? And I want to talk to you a little bit more about this whole notion of how you're helping people in terms of their finances with with these instant communication devices.
Sure.
Hi, it's time for another tip from Sandler Training. Traditional sales training teaches techniques on how to eliminate stalls and objections. Some are fancy sales moves, while others are programmed responses. Sales is a conversation, and I don't know how you can memorize every possible response for every sales situation. Also, the prospect has usually heard these responses before and has been turned off by some fancy sales move. When you really think about it, the only person qualified to address the stall or objection is the prospect. Ask the right questions, and you will eliminate stalls and objections. And that's another tip from Sandler Training, finding power through reinforcement.
Well, welcome back to the Pilgrim on the 405. We've been talking to Kelly Peeler, who is the CEO of NextGen Best. And Kelly has a lot of experience and studied the whole notion of financial catastrophe, calamity, surprises, and I want to talk a little bit about what she sees as the future of digitization and how that's affecting the way that we deal with finances, both individually in terms of small business and maybe even corporately. So, Kelly, tell us a little bit about how you see the change in how people are dealing with their finances because of the internet and digitization.
Sure. So I'd say it can be broadly thought of in terms of a couple different buckets. One, we're moving towards a consumer demand for high levels of convenience. So sort of gone are the days where 9-to-5 banking can and should exist. The second is high amounts of personalization. So, again, gone are the days where you can just have one-size-fits-all products and services that are supposed to be catered to people who are both 25 and 65. And the last is, I would say, is really around the medium that people are paying attention to and engaging with financial services. So, again, gone are the days where you might walk into a retail branch for the first time and take out a loan. Every single different element of financial services is being disrupted in terms of catering to those three buckets around convenience, personalization, and the medium that people are actually interacting.
Well, I noticed that there's a number of different apps that are allowing people to share money with each other, like.
Yep.
Venmo is one. I noticed Wells Fargo came out with just last week, told me in my account that now I can share money with I don't know who, but apparently a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the user that we deal with, so our user base is Gen Z, so younger than millennials even, the Snapchat generation, if you want to call them that, they represent the 70 million people who will be entering the financial services for the first time. They've grown up on their phone and specifically on Messenger platforms. So a lot of financial institutions are still confused with millennials. So I am a millennial as a 29-year-old. I have a phone, but I didn't literally grow up through my teens with a phone. So I need that idea of having like something on-demand, convenient, that's really fitted for me. But it's a totally different experience for people, for Gen Z, who have actually literally grown up on tablets and phone devices, who also have zero brand loyalty to existing financial institutions.
And so what are you noticing that they are doing?
Noticing that they're doing is not using the traditional products. So so the reason why companies like Venmo are able to grow incredibly quickly is because they're speaking the language and on the medium that a very specific type of audience is actually wants to pay attention to. So in my mind, things like retail branches will be sort of obsolete because a lot of young people don't actually like human-to-human face-to-face conversation. They actually like texting or messenger-based communication. and seeing kind of, I think, a lot more interest in trying newer products, newer financial products that more quickly prioritize things like personalization and design, as opposed to, you know, like a huge balance sheet, for example. So if you're, in my mind, the timing is really right to think about starting a consumer fintech company, because at no other really point in time are people as concerned with the, you know, like the current brands as being the only way that you can make financial decisions.
Well, it's interesting to me. In running my business, I felt like I needed to increase my credit line with Wells Fargo for about $10,000. And that meant I filled out a two-page application, sent it in. 2 weeks later, they called me on the phone and wanted to confirm a couple of things. And then they said, well, you know, in the next 5 to 10 days, we will get back to you with a decision. During that same period, I decided to go ahead and pay some expenses, and invest in some areas, and I was using PayPal.
Yeah.
And right down the bottom, PayPal says, well, why not use PayPal credit? Well, in no time at all, it didn't seem like more than 30 seconds, I had gotten a significant credit line established, and it was done.
Yep.
And it was interest-free.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing. Yep. How in the world are commercial banks going to compete with that? With that immense...
My answer is that they're not. I think that there's the financial services will have its Amazon moment in the next, 10 years easily. Because, and what I mean by that is, Amazon, just with the purchase of Whole Foods in the past several weeks for $14 billion, is now, going into grocery shopping, And they started off with books. So thinking that was only, not even a substantial amount of years ago, like 7 years ago, they started off with books, and now they're eating groceries, books, all on online shopping, because they're really focused on the end consumer, convenient and having a convenient and low price or low cost experience. And so if that speed can change where Amazon is now, I'd say substantially better position than Walmart. What does that entity or that challenge look like for the financial services industry? I think to your point, I think it's coming very soon, because a lot of banks are just not set up to deliver that convenient and trusted experience to the extent that a lot of other companies are taking small niches of decision-making or experiences.
Well, just as a side note, isn't it going to be interesting to combine Amazon's we don't care about profit business plan with Whole Foods, which sometimes referred to as Whole Paycheck?
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll see what happens there.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I would say that like a lot of things will happen there, but a lot of financial institutions, in my opinion, will be caught surprised that all of a sudden additional banks have grown up very quickly without them kind of taking them seriously.
Well, aren't we also going to be impacted with the effect of microloans and microcredit, because that's been so successful abroad? And why would that not work here with startups?
Yeah, so there's a few companies that are doing micro versions of credit. The real kind of innovation there that's been happening is that you can, if you look to things like credit scores, they're really kind of outdated measures of seeing if someone is credit worthy. And now that you have things like your phone, which people input thousands of data points of personal information through constantly, you can think about what credit worthiness means in a totally different context. So that's why we think a lot about the focus of the medium and what does it mean to build product for a user who's used to giving that type of information up on their phone. So yes, I mean, anything from lending to thinking about, like on the consumer side, on the mortgage side, or on the real estate side, to using blockchain, to like any element of financial services will be dramatically changed because consumer behavior patterns are changing. So well, it's not super big news, but I think a lot of people are underestimating that.
Well, also, you know, for mid-sized businesses that have been operating for 10 or 15 years, they have patterns that they have followed, and now those are being impacted. What I see is some of the work that we're doing with some CPA firms in terms of developing advisory programs for real advisory programs, much like what you're doing with individual students, we are doing with companies to help them double their income and their revenue in 12 to 24 months. And so some of the things involve them moving to online accounting packages. And when we do that, there's a plethora of programs that can be used to help them use the CPA's advisory services much more effectively. I mean, to be able to see every day, where are we on track toward our annual revenue and profit goals?
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. And then when you come into the bank for a loan or increase in your credit line, you have all the information. You have the projections. You have all of this material. And for the CPA, it was pushing a button.
I can't imagine not doing it that way. So, I mean, we use, like, why would I pay for someone to do something if I can do it by easily linking my accounts and, you know, being able to see a holistic picture in real time, anytime, of what we're, where the state of our company is. So I would say that if a CPA is not using that platform, they are in trouble.
Well, and when you take a look at least the projection of the one-page tax reform, all of a sudden the only deductions are for charity and home mortgage. That is an enormous amount of business for CPAs who relied on tax returns right out the window.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that there's kind of two options for that. For those people is one to really come up to speed as quickly as possible with those tools and somehow deliver like what a premium service would look like, whether it's giving that, having that trusted relationship, or to find something else to do.
That's right. Either grow very, very quickly, or hope that you can afford to play golf every day.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, Kelly, if you had a megaphone and you could speak to students in Southern California, you tell them to do?
I would tell them to sign up for nextgenbest.com so that we could be helping them at, like, you know.
Right. Well, we're going to talk to you about the low and middle income people in Orange County who really do need this kind of service and help. But all right, so that's one. And let's suppose that you're not active in their neighborhood. What suggest to them?
Is to first and foremost to fill out the FAFSA, which comes out in October 1st, and that will allow you to get free federal aid if you qualify. The third is really to come up with an actual plan. So a lot of, as I was mentioning before, a lot of students will just take out obscene amounts of money with zero actual plan. And the reason why is because it's very complex. But that doesn't mean you can't kind of easily just do back of the envelope calculations on saying things like, okay, if 4 years is going to cost me X, and I look at a school's alumni employment statistics, so I'm conceivably going to be making Y in this major that I might be thinking about studying, then how many years will that take to pay off? Do I want to take 10 years? Do I want to take 30 years? And actually make a decision. We see students and families doing zero of that, even very simple back of the envelope calculation. So I would say in a most basic form, come up with a very simple plan.
So really begin seeing college as an investment in a business plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not, and it's again, like why I believe that the student loan market is ripe for being the next financial crisis is because it's a socialized economic decision now to just take out massive amounts of student loans. It's not a economic decision. So that what I mean by that is to be, if you're thinking of investing in yourself and your future, to come up with a plan on how you actually have an ROI, obviously, on that, your return on your investment, but then also say, okay, if this is not the return on investment that I want or I'm projecting, let's think about other options like community college, like vocational training, like online web development classes, things like that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, wonderful. Well, so tell us a little bit about, for a 29-year-old CEO of a very successful, socially supportive program, what's next? Where do you see yourself in the next 10 years?
I'm continuing to run NextGenVest, and I would say being the go-to trusted partner for the Snapchat generation to make all their major financial decisions, serving a high percentage of college-bound students in every major city in the U.S., and then more broadly thinking about two additional things really is advocating to change policy for students on things like around that predatory and fraudulent elements to this decision-making process. And on the second bucket is really thinking about, are there other ways that we can add value to continue the relationship with students? Is it extending the relationship past college? Is it introducing our own financial products for students? So we broadly see ourselves as the trusted financial partner and institution for the Snapchat generation.
Now, as students begin to be aware that their life really is hemmed and constrained if they don't pay attention by financial situations, as they do that, they're going to be operating much more like what businesses operated like 20 years ago, right? Paying attention to not only what's my income, but what's my savings? How am I investing this? What's the return? Where are we going? And it's not just what can we afford. In Southern California, very often that gets translated into how much can I pay a month? not what's the long-term advantage of this? So yeah. How do you see that playing out in terms of businesses as they begin to businesses?
Yeah, I think that like anything from lending to businesses will change. But do you mean students taking on businesses or financial services?
No, as businesses. As students become business people, as they given the DIY and the digitization that's available, there's a lot of people who are going to be running their own businesses.
Quote unquote gig economy, meaning you hold multiple different jobs. You have the freedom of kind of time, so you don't necessarily have to go into a 9-to-5 location, but that might mean that you, because you have more flexibility, you now have the ability to have different streams of income. So that will obviously continue. But I think that a lot of businesses who are hiring millennials will need to really understand that they have totally different concerns than someone who maybe just wanted like a nice job for 30 years and then they could retire. This audience wants a totally different kind of package in their career. Anything from helping them pay off their student loans to career advancement, learning new skills, things like that. So what I would say more broadly is they want, how they're going to be thinking about it is their financial identity will have already been determined at that time. So I'm really curious to see if there's a lot more uprising around a lot of people understanding that they can't go and work in the city that they want or the job that they want because they already have $37,000 of student loan debt before even getting their first job.
Sounds like very similar to third world debt.
Yeah, I'd say, unfortunately, it's within the U.S. and there seems to be no changes to it anytime soon.
I mean, it's just similar constraints to what happened with third world debt. I mean, once you get there, you're in the hole. Well, I also hear the seeds of another interview specifically about what it is that you see millennials want.
Yeah, what I see them wanting are a few different things. One is skill development. So the change, I don't have the exact stat off the top of my head, but millennials are changing jobs many more times and much quicker than baby boomers had previously. So just in thinking about career trajectory, it will completely change. You can reinvent your career multiple times. But what's the counter to that is that you need a lot of skill development to be able to do that. So I think places that offer a lot of skill, constant re-education will be great places to find talent. The second is frankly around student loan repayment. So a lot of companies are introducing things like as a corporate benefit or bonus structure, paying off your student loans.
Interesting.
And then the third, I'd say, is really around finding how do you discover jobs that and the actual curation process. So, again, that's because people are changing jobs much more frequently.
Right. Well, Kelly, this has been fascinating. Fascinating. I really appreciate that. And it looks to me like you have a beautiful day coming ahead in Connecticut. We have a wonderful day here in Laguna Beach. That's going to be a lot of fun. One more time, tell people how to get involved.
Just to go on our website. or if anyone has students, they can follow us on Snapchat as well.
And you tell me, how do people follow you on Snapchat?
At NextGenVest.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Kelly. We look forward to talking with you again sometime in the future.
Sure, thank you. Have a good day.
Have a great day. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.